Hi again. So welcome to the second demonstration session. And this week we have again three analytical exercises and three computer exercises. Do you have any practical questions related to the practicalities of the courses, or is everything fine? We can also continue with them later on.
Yeah, if we at some point maybe go through the instructions first.
Home sample.
Yeah, homicide, even if it's there, but
Yeah. Yes. I think we'll do that later,
yeah, it may be.
in few weeks since so let's go to instru usually we're going through the instructions at last week. That's on the after the fifth demonstrations, but I think we could go them like in 2 weeks now or something. So we'll see. The thing is that if you look what you're asked to do in a home assignment, there are a lot of things we haven't thought yet. So if we went there now, we would have to come back again.
It's also about maybe the structure of how it
Okay.
looks more instead of. I know that the tools are not there yet for us, but the structure, we can go through that also then,
Yeah.
but just a heads up for you.
So let's look on the question sheet. Demonstration two. So the first assignment, so it's related to the stationarity of the armor model. So here, or in particular, you're asked to, by examining the characteristic equation, you're asked to check whether the model is stationary or not. So let's begin with. So here you have the equation. It's autoregressive of order two. So here you have the values of the y and then the lagged values. So first of all, we rewrite this equation using a lagged polynomial. So here, we have done here just move these terms from the right-hand side to the left-hand side, and then use the lagged polynomials for the y term. So, for example, when there's a singular L, it's lagged minus one and squared lagged minus two. So, first of all, we rewrite the equation. And then, when we look this thing, within the square brackets, we can see that it looks like a standard quadratic equation. So let's just use the standard techniques of the quadratic equation and solve it. So in our case, when we do that, we want that both of these roots are higher than one. And when this condition is met, our model is stationary. So, first of all, let's rewrite the model here, multiplying it with the second squared, with the constant of the squared term, and we get this equation. And then we replace the lagged polynomials by the z, as we want to solve this as a characteristic equation. And then we use a standard quadratic equation to solve z. So I believe you're all familiar with this stuff. And then we get two different roots. One is lower than one, and one is higher than one. So as the condition that all the roots are not higher than one is not met, this model is non-stationary. And stationarity, in a weak sense, stationarity means that the mean term and the variance term of the series are constant. I'll show you some examples later on, or maybe I'll show you here one example of a stationary series. So, for example, in here, this is a time frame, and we have equation that goes like this. So, when our mean term is constant, our series evolves around the mean term. There's some constant center moment in the series. And then when our out variance moment, second moment is stationary, the limits of the variability are constant. So that's the meaning of the weak sense of the stationarity. In strict sense or in strong sense, stationarity means that all the observations have the same the probability distribution. That's the strong sense of the distribution. But that's just for a note. Weak stationarity means that the covariance or the outer covariance of the term or of the variable is constant, and the mean or the center moment of the variable is constant. Second question. Okay, second. A researcher has some has estimated some data, some log likelihood values based on different orders of the ARMA model, B being the AR order and MI being the moving average order. So here, so we are asked to, using informational criteria, we are asked to calculate what's the optimal order of this model. So let's open Excel. Interesting. Your privacy matters, says Excel. Well, now you're able to see it. We have every now and then we just get these all kind of messages related to the to the firewall, for example, like earlier with the Excel. So every time I see them, I get afraid that something bad will happen, but this wasn't the case this time. So, okay, what have we done here? Just look at the columns A and B. We're taking the values from the question. Then we calculate the number of the parameters. So in this case, we have 0-0 ARMA model. So why have we included a one variable, one parameter there? What is it? It's the constant term. So as you can see, when you ever increase the numbers of the orders, the numbers of the parameters will also increase. Number of the order plus one being always the constant term. Then we have the observations. And then we take the formulas of the Akaike information criteria, Schwarz information criteria, and Hanna-Quick information criteria, and calculate informational value. So informational criteria, the thing to look from the informational criteria is that lower the value, better the informational fit. Why is this the case? Because the lower value implies a lower residual element in the model. So lower the informational value, the better the given orders are able to explain the variation in the model. So applying different formulas, for example, with the Akaike, we get 3 and 2 is the optimal criteria, but then applying Schwarz and Hannah Quicking, we get 2 and 1. So according to these three information criteria, there's no clear-cut solution. Two of them says it's 2 and 1, and one of them says it's 3 and 2. So then the question becomes which one is more likely the better option. And here, let's compare the informational criteria of the Akaike and Schwarz. The key difference between them is that higher the numbers of the parameter, that the key difference between the Akaike and Schwarz is that Schwarz or BIC punishes from including more parameters in the model. So that's why to calculate, that's why the measure differs. And in other words, you could say that Schwarz gives us more parsimonious model. It has a lower amount of orders there. So I recommend to, if you have to choose from these two metrics, I'd use Schwarz because of the parsimoniosity. We want to put lower amount of stuff. We do not want to complicate our model more that is necessary. We want to, so in other words, there's a trade-off between expanding our models and with the simplicity of the results. So you could think in that way that when you put more stuff into your model, yeah, for sure, it could become more realistic, but the downside of the realisticness is that you could put there a lot of unnecessary stuff, and because of this unnecessary stuff, your model works actually worse than the model that has a lower amount of stuff. So
you just kind of
p-values, there are no p-values. It's just a metric that is calculated. So it's like a metric for an informational fit. So given the likelihood function and number of the parameters. It just calculates what's the informational bit of the model. There's nothing else. So
there's no fixed tests like that.
Yes, there. And later on, I believe it's in the fourth exercise, we will go a little bit deeper into this information criteria. But the thing is that use informational criteria with care. They can be helpful, but usually you shouldn't. They're not like the holy book that will tell you that this is the underlying structure. They can be helpful. They can give you hints about the underlying process, but that's the best thing that the informational criteria can do. Third exercise, this has two parts. It's about identification of armor model using autocorrelation and partial autocorrelation functions. And the second one is the autocorrelation test. In the first case, what we do, we want to calculate the boundary where the series goes to zero. If we look at this, if we eyeball how these numbers evolve, we observe that autocorrelation function most likely cuts to zero in order two or three. So there's a drop from the previous value to a lower value. There's a sharper drop. Whereas as values of the partial autocorrelation values, they seem to be more like a decaying. There's no dramatic drop. They are rather decaying. So just by looking at these values, that the partial autocorrelation values decay under AIC, ACF drops to zero, it's most likely this model is a moving average of order one or two. So how to determine that? We calculate the confidence interval, the boundaries where the order drops to zero. And that can be done by using the standard formula of the test statistics of the normal distribution multiplied by the squared inverse of observations. And we get the value that the boundary is 0.106 with 100 observations, and our second order is below that, implying that just by looking at the autocorrelation function and partial autocorrelation function, our model is MI1, moving average of order one. So the autocorrelation function cuts in order two. That implies that the order is minus one from that. So it's minus from that minus. So MI1 is order that's above the threshold. Threshold, we calculated the confidence intervals. We look also at these functions later in the fourth exercise. And then the B exercise. In a B exercise, that's about the autocorrelation test. So given the data above, we're asked to calculate whether this series has a first three autocorrelation coefficients are jointly different from zero. And we're applying Lung box text. So this line here is the general test statistics. And then we take the data, we have 100 observations, and we have three orders we want to calculate. So again, standard exercise of doing a statistical inference, what's the first thing we want to do? We ask, what is our hypothesis? What are we testing? That's the first thing we have to understand when we're doing a statistical inference. And here, the test is that three first orders are jointly zero. Then in the second phase, we calculate our test statistics. The general formula is given above. We just plug the stuff there. T there is 100, T there is 100, and M there is 3. And we'll just calculate the test statistics, and it's almost 20. Then in the third place, we compare our test statistic to the critical value of the probability distribution, whether it is higher or lower the threshold. And as our case in 5%, with the 5% critical limit is around 8, and with 1% is 11. And our test statistic is higher than both of them. We reject the null in both cases, implying that we reject the null that these three orders are together jointly zero, or in other words, there is autocorrelation in the series. Then the fourth exercises here, as a hint for you for the home assignment. In the home assignment, you're asked to do a armor modeling together with a forecasting. So just take a note here that questions 4 and 5 are things you have to show that you can do in your home assignment. So it's time to open the R. R is here. First of all, I assume you have all downloaded the data and the R code files. Then let's press session, set working directory, choose directory, and there let's set the working directory. So now the R should be able to know the right folder where the data and everything is. So first of all, let's load the libraries, how to highlight. Highlight it, shift was arrows to run, control, enter. So now we have loaded the libraries. Next, let's load the data. It seems like, again, it's taking forever. Okay, now it has loaded the data. If you want to glance the data, just click here. Now you can see the first column is the timeline, and then we have Eurostoxx, S&P 500 index, and the VIX series. You're familiar with the VIX series. It's the so-called fear index. It's based on the next 30 days of the futures of the S&P 500. So it's about how in this moment or this date, how the markets are pricing the S&P 500 in next 30 days. So it's a forward-looking measure. So it's the so-called fear index, implying that when the value of the VIX is high, the fear in the markets is high, and when the value is low, markets are really calm. So let's how can we take the data here? The dollar sign is important again. What does it do? This is the name of our data frame, and dollar sign specifies the variable we want to extract from the data. So df dollar sign data, that's the VIX variable, and then let's calculate the length. Then secondly, let's calculate the returns. Here, first of all, we are interested in the log differences. So the thing is that when we're using log differences, for example, in this case, it's delta, it's change, log change in, for example, variable xt equals the values of the xt and its previous value. And this log difference is approximately the same as relative difference of the series. So in this case,
so it also here made it a little bit better. Here we have a series x d. The log difference of it is, and this difference is relatively the same as the change in series.
So, in other words, we're studying the relative changes of this series and not the prices in themselves. And some reminder from the code here, a colon sign here specifies an incremental of 1 here. So in this case, from 2 to n, means from 2 to 259 incremental, it increases in one value there, incremental of one value from 2 to a little bit over 200, and then here one value below it. So let's take the relative differences and set these as time series. Ts is a function for time series. The variable in question, the start date, the end date, and the frequency of the data, 12, implies that the data is monthly. Then let's look at the series. What are the summer statistics of the Eurostoxx returns? Median is a little bit higher than the mean. And then when we compare the minimum value and the maximum value to the minimum value is a little bit relatively lower than the maximum value, whereas, and then the third quarter is a little bit further away from mean than the first negative quarter, and the median is a little bit higher than mean. So just by looking at the standard statistic, we should be, our preliminary assumption is that this distribution is a little bit left skewed, meaning that there's more weight on the right-hand side, so it looks like this. There's more weight here. This is the distribution. So some left skewness in the series. Then let's look at the standard errors, the series. So here, there are two ways. Standard errors of the series is the same as taking the standard deviation of the series, dividing it by the square root of the number of the observations. So here, if we look at the standard deviation, we get a lot higher value than the standard error. But why to look at standard error? It's because given this value here, we're able to make a preliminary assumption where the mean center moment of this series is it's 0.05 plus and minus 0.33. It's somewhere over there is the mean moment. And then secondly, let's look at the S&P 500 summary statistic, and they should be pretty similar. And given the similarity of the values, mean and the minimum and maximum and the first and third quarter and median, we can see just by comparing these values that these equity markets of the United States and Europe correlate closely together. So it's like an observation that these both equity markets are global. Their investor base is global. All investors, so in other words, investors from the United States can invest in euro stocks and vice versa. Again, we observe the series has some left skewness. Yeah, that's a little bit less, more mass on the right-hand side. And then let's look at the fear index VIX. Here, first and third quarter are okay. Actually, there's also a little bit left skewness here, some left skewness. So let's look at that. No, actually, this series behaves more like a normal distribution, meaning that the shape of the distribution is more symmetric, but there's some. This series has some kurtosis, that means bigness, or in other words, fat tails. So there are a lot of seems like outlier events. So in the case of VIX, when there's a positive increase of, let's say, like over 50, that's like a close to financial crash. Let's look at the series here. This is a VIX series, how it looks like. There's a lot of time. You can see it evolves around center moment. So it's stationary in that sense. But secondly, there are a lot of different peak periods. So for example, here, 2008, that's probably related to the Lehman bankruptcy. And then the variability increases over time. So this is actually interesting, because since the 2010s, the VIX index was in general quite low, implying that on a level sense, the risk was quite minimal. But when we look at the differences, these translate into big differences. So in a relative sense, even though the level of the series was low, small changes make big differences. Let's compare the series. First of all, let's take the Euro stocks and S&P 500. So just by looking at the summary statistic, we got an intuition that these changes of the both stock market indices correlate closely. And indeed, that seems to be the case also by visually looking at the statistic. When either of the series is going up, also another is, and when one is going downwards, also another is. There seems to be a high correlation between these stock series. Then let's add, yes?
Can you specify how we can see that they correlate closely?
How they correlate closely? They move in the same direction.
Right.
So correlation is a technical or more fancy word for a moving close together, nothing else.
I was looking at the summary print that didn't tell me, but that makes sense to look at the actual.
Yeah. And then let's add the fear index. So before seeing the data, we would think that the fear index would move in a negative other direction. When both markets are going down, fear is going up. So when markets are crashing, fear is high. let's see how these spikes are related to the different economic events. For example, beginning of the 2000, there was March of 2000 was the peak of the dot-com bubble. So probably, as you can see before that, indices were going up and up and down, or up, huge upward increases. So, and then there's a peak, and then we start to see indices crashing downwards. Another is the August of 2007 is the beginning of the global financial crisis, and that's what happened in August 2007. That was when three hedge funds or mortgage-related funds of was it BNP Paribas or some major investment bank went bankrupt. So that was the point when the financial crisis started. Here we can see after a while stock starts to hit downwards. And here this downward spike is probably the bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers. The fear is extraordinarily high and the markets are crashing down. Let's what happened in the August 2015. That's when the it's a little bit before these spikes when the China reformed its currency basket. So it's not directly related to the spikes. And then let's look what happened during the COVID-19 pandemic. The last line. Again, we see that huge increase in fear and markets crashing down. So now we have done the visual analysis of the series. Let's go more into more technical stuff. So first of all, we applied Box Yenking's procedure to to identify, estimate, and diagnostics checking for the series. So here, the first phase is using the autocorrelation and partial autocorrelation function. So here, the difference is what is a autocorrelation function? It gives a linear relationship between the present value and past values of the series. It is just a linear code movement, how the present value of the series go moves it first lag and then other lags. Partial autocorrelation function. I'll leave the partial autocorrelation function here because immediately I can't remember a good intuition to say what's a partial autocorrelation function. But the idea is, for example, take the present value of the series and regress it by the lagged values, and then take another values of the series, like -3, and regress it by the same lagged values as the present lagged values. And when you've done this OLS estimation, just take the residuals of the series and correlate them, study the, so the partial autocorrelation function studies the correlation between the present value and lagged values. I've written here direct and unique relationship between the lags and the present value. But I don't I think the intuition is should be clear. But overall, let's when let's actually make a Google. Yeah, here is a one example. For example, in this case, you observe that there's a series that decaying slowly. Autocorrelation function is decaying slowly, and then there's a partial autocorrelation function that goes sharply to the zero. So most likely, given these characteristics of this function, this is a AR1 function. Yeah, autocorrelation, yes. So that's to give you the intuition about how to use this series. So in other words, I show you an ideal example of the AR1 AR series where autocorrelation functions decays gradually and a partial function drops to zero after a lag. So if you see that kind of autocorrelation function and partial autocorrelation function, you have a quite strong intuition that you're dealing with the autoregressive series. But usually it is the case that when we look at these functions, they do not tell us much. But nevertheless, let's look what of these partial functions say about Eurostoxx. So for example, here, our autocorrelation function drops to zero immediately. So if this function, partial autocorrelation function, would behave like a gradually decaying series, we would have a MI actually. This should be also above one, but if this first lag would be above this blue line, we would have MI1 series. But here, just by looking at these graphs, only thing we can conclude is we have no idea about this series. Here the value of 0.5 is half year, 6 months. And as our Eurostoxx and S&P 500 correlate closely, most likely the S&P 500 gives us similar pictures. Yep, it looks like the earlier one. But then in addition, let's look at the VIX. Also, that's also the case. Oh, actually here, look at the graph above ACF. It cuts to zero in lag two, implying that it could possibly be AR of order one. But then when we look at the partial autocorrelation function, it's kind of decaying, but kind of not so. So to conclude, just by looking at the autocorrelation function and partial autocorrelation function, we were not able to make any firm conclusions. Then the second stage of the procedure, box yankings, let's calculate the information criteria. And that we're doing using auto arima function. So here, this slot is the variable. Then we set a max AR order to be 12 and max MI order being 12. And max number D refers here to the differences. We set them 0 because our series is stationary, already stationary. And here IC specifies the information criteria. First, we use Akaike. And we get, and our calculating the information criteria, we'll conclude that our series is a MI of order 1. So here, you're most likely wondering what are these capital letters here. These are the orders for the seasonality, but they are not relevant in this case. Why? Because we are dealing with the stock market. Stocks markets are not like ice cream. There are no periods when more ice cream is sold. Rather, stock markets behave all over the year the same way. That's a better intuition to think about stock markets. So according to the Akaike, we have Arma 01. And yes?
Then what does it mean? What does it mean, the seasonality effect, that T1 and T2?
Yes.
What does it mean, that MA and AR and MA? What is it?
Okay, so what do these refer to? Okay. As I can't remember immediately, let's check it. So question mark, help, name of the function. Okay, it says here only that. Okay, it does not specify these orders. So I believe I rather than speaking something out of my head, I remain silent here because, but check that one. Just how to check it? We can also check that one. Let's just take Google. Let's check what is the meaning of the, okay. This gives us, okay, understanding seasonal order of the Sarima, seasonal Arima model. Let's look what do these say. Okay. We would have to pay a little bit something in order to see that. Just for case of interest, let's look if here are something. Sorry, I wasn't able to find a quick answer, but. Yeah, so it's like seasonality.
If we're achieving the global index, if we're focusing on a small p, small d, and a small p.
Yes.
Okay.
But I'm trying to think of a more intuitive answer. So, for example, if you think about price of oil, for example, it can have some seasonal effects, for example. So in that case, if there are seasonalities involved, B could be related to the persistence of the seasonalities and the capital Q about the news impact of the seasonalities or moving average impact of the seasonalities. But that's something I recommend to look for somewhere. But just for the case of intuition, because I'm not 100% certain, I do not use that function. It has never been relevant in my research. So okay, then secondly, let's calculate the SWARTZ information criteria using SWARTZ, and we get 0, 0. So again, Akaike tells us 0 and 1, and SWARTZ tells us 0 and 0. So what's the right answer? We don't know yet. Let's look at the S&P 500. Akaike. Again, we should have some seasonality impacts. Okay, this is interesting. According to the Akaike information criteria, S&P 500 has a 2 AR orders and 1 MI order, and then a bit different seasonalities. But these series correlate closely, so why are they not the same? Why is there difference between the Euro stocks and S&P 500? Let's look at SWARTZ. It should be 0, 0 again. Zero, zero. So when there are no lags, it's like the process would be, that would be on the left hand side. That's maybe a difference. Then there's a constant term and then some error term. So it's like only the error term is moving the process. Most likely that's not the case. And why? Because here we're applying our, when we use information criteria, we're assuming that our underlying model is linear, and most likely our underlying model is non-linear. And why so? Just look at this picture. The variation of the series is not constant. It's sometimes the variation is higher, and then there are spikes. So most likely there's something nonlinear happening in the series. This nonlinearity could be related to the variation, or it could be related to the mean term. But there's some nonlinearity involved. So when we tested the information criteria, we assumed that this series would be well behaving with constant mean and constant variation. Or to say it in other words, we applied a model that's not enough for understanding the underlying process of this time series. Then let's look at the information criteria of the VIX series. According to both Akaike and SWARTZ, it is ARMA 1 and 1. So this is first clear-cut answer, but let's look again the series, how reliable our result is. And again, we observe there's a variation in variance. So again, some variance is not constant, but it seems sometimes the variation is lower and sometimes it's higher. And especially during the crisis period, it is bad. So, to conclude, using information criteria, we were not able to detect a clear suggestion for the both stock series, but both of the Akaike and Schwartz information criteria said that it is ARMA 1-1. So we have a hint. There could be something in ARMA 1-1 model. Then the next stage, let's estimate our model. So according to the Akaike information criteria, the optimal order is MI1. So let's take ARIMA function that estimates a ARIMA or ARMA model. That's our series. Then let's specify the order. That's MI1. And then let's apply the estimation method where here CSS refers to the OLS. So let's calculate our parameters. Here, there's a little bit lower amount of information given than, for example, in the first during the first demonstration session. But this information is enough. We can use this information to calculate the statistical inference of the series. So, for example, in order to calculate the statistical significance of the MI1 order, let's just take the parameter and calculate the value of the parameter. So this is our test statistics. It's probably like 1.6, 1.5. So it's for sure it is below the critical test threshold of the distributional value, but how can we can also calculate the p-value just by taking this value and then adjusting it to the degrees of freedom. So we have n is the number of observations and how many parameters we have this model to MI1 and intercept. So let's calculate the p-value. Something's wrong. Could not find function p. Okay, it should be pt. So that's our p-value. It's above the 0.05, so we're on the acceptance region. The null stays in power. The parameter is not statistically significant. And applying the same technique, so dividing the intercept by its standard errors, we can see that it is also not statistically significant. Secondly, let's calculate the other alternative. 1.2 was okay, it was suggestion for the S&P 500. So we apply the given degrees in this model. So here we have an interesting result. The model is not working at all. It's not able to calculate its standard errors. So it seems to be the case that something is wrong here. So instead of using OLS, let's try a maximum likelihood estimation technique. This estimator is better able to deal with nonlinearities, and let's calculate the series again. And we're able to get some values.
There was some kind of nonlinearity in here, and that's why tuning was not. You need to determine which one would be there.
Yes. So let's again look at the series. So this is what we are estimating here. There are all kind of these spikes. So most likely these outlier events all around the series are affecting the estimator so that it just doesn't work. Because when we apply this estimator, we are assuming that our variance term is constant. We are assuming that there's no autocorrelation. We are assuming there's no heteroscedasticity. And just by looking at this series, we can be quite sure that we're violating these assumptions. But the estimator assumes these assumptions. So we are applying a technique that's not applicable. So here again, can you see immediately whether the parameters are statistically significant or not? Or do I go one example? The thing is, you just take the parameter and just then divide it by its standard errors. And if the value is above 2, the parameter is statistically significant. So in this case, it's most likely even below 1. And neither of these parameters, when we just take some value and divide it by its standard errors, we can see it's not above 2. The critical threshold is 1.96. So we want that our test statistic is above that. So to make some conclusion about using OLS and ML estimator, this result suggests that probably we should control these events here. These outlier events are so severe that our estimators are not functioning properly.
How to do that?
In this case, in Arima. Yes, if I can remember correctly, we should be able to set a. So again, help and function fixed. Okay, here. Here are all kind of different options. Xrec, yes, it's here. So in the standard case, there are no external regressors in the series. There are no X variables on the right-hand side. But if we want to, we can set them here. I'll just leave that into that. Let's see whether there's an example given. There's an example given, okay, here. For example, here is one example. That is a function, and then someone has specified the Xrec external regressors, and that's the external regressor there.
And that is controlled.
Yeah, that's so enough. So you can control. You just generate the variable and put it here in the Xrec, and you're able to control them. I haven't made the ready variables for this outlier dummies, so I can't show them here. I would have to start coding them, and it would take some time. So let's skip them. Then, in addition, there was one suggestion that it is a ARMA 1-1 model. So here, MI1 order is not statistically significant, so let's throw it away and estimate the model without it. Okay, now it starts to, now we're getting some results here. Threw one unnecessary variable away, and we're able to get find some statistical significance. So ARMA 1.1 could be our model, or at least something we should look more closely. So here in this case, take this value divided by this, it's quite high value, it is statistically significant. Take this value and divide it by this, and it is quite high value, it's statistically significant. So that was the case for the Euro stocks. Let's look at S&P 500, and let's only look at two different options, ARMA 2.1, two ARMA orders and one MI order. Here, not statistically significant, not statistically significant, not statistically significant. And again, how to calculate that, take the value and divide it by its standard errors. And if this value is higher than 1 point, you have a statistical significance. No. Okay, let's do it again. Let's remove another AR order. AR order. And see how the results change. Again, we're able to find statistical significance. So it seems that there is some, in other words, if we add too much unnecessary stuff there, we lose accuracy in the model. So when we decrease the number of the parameters, we'll able to get more accurate results. So here again, how to see whether parameter is statistically significant, take the value, divide it by its standard errors, and use a logical expressions, and it will say whether it's significant or not. So again, two options according our preliminary results, both stock series are something like ARMA 1.1 models. Then the WIGS, and again, both parameters are statistically significant. Taking the value of the parameter and dividing it by its standard errors, and it should be around approximately above 2. In the next phase, it's about a diagnostic testing. So it's about testing the autocorrelation in the function. So autocorrelation is a bad thing in a model, as it implies that if we have autocorrelation in the model, that means that our error term conditional on the regressors, our error term is not independent from the regressors. And that's one of the assumptions we want to be true. So in the flow and in an equation, that when we take the expectations of the series conditionals on the changes, this is when we have autocorrelation in the series, this assumption does not hold. And
In particular, let's use a little bit better example. Let's us change from xt by its lag value. So if that assumption does not hold, and we would subtract if that assumption does not hold, and we started to calculate our regressors, we would find that we have bias there.
So Jung box test, let's take a Eurostock series and assume 20 lags and test whether there's an autocorrelation. So in statistical test, what's the first thing we ask? What are we testing? What is our hypothesis? So in this case, the hypothesis is that all of these lags are jointly zero. No autocorrelation. If we reject the null, it's more probable that there's autocorrelation in the series. That stuff. So the null is no autocorrelation. We calculate the test statistic and compare it to the probability distribution, and we get the p-value of 0.7. The null stays in power. We have no autocorrelation in the series. And this is a good sign. That means that when we added one AR and MI order in the model, we were able to remove the possible autocorrelation from the model.
But there's one thing, but in time series analysis,
yes,
you usually find autocorrelations, don't you? Like, really common thing in time series analysis. Without that, actually, how could I? I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. Isn't it pretty usual to find autocorrelation in time series?
In our time series, all the time.
All the time, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the common sense. That of course, we are just arranging the JR some of the times, so there must be some kind of relationship between them.
Yes. But here, the correlation auto means that the series is correlating with itself.
Itself, yeah.
Yes, auto correlation.
Yeah,
series.
So there must be some kind of relation between itself, okay?
Yes, it could be, but it could be that there's no relationship. For example, you remember
the example that in this case, that there's only an error term.
Oh, yeah.
So there's no other correlation if the assumptions are true. It's only the error term that's moving the model.
Okay.
But there could be a...
But autocorrelation is not the same thing as the persistence in the series, or not like a moving error term in a series. Like autocorrelation, you could model autocorrelation either using autoregressive orders or moving average orders. So yes. So in that, for example, if we have AR1 order in the model, that means that there's a persistence in the series. To sharpen your intuition, think about what inflation looks like. It's really, I can show you also, let's show a picture here. So for example, in this case, that's a few years ago, you observe that this series is behaving really persistently, that when it's going upwards, it's going strongly upwards. It's not reverting downwards. So if you look at like a series like this, you could say you have most likely you have here a autoregressive coefficient close to one. It's a really high persistence in the series. That's an intuition how to think about AR order. Intuitively, how to think about a moving average order is like thinking it like a news shock.
It needs to come down again.
Yes. Down. So, for example, Nokia gives a bad report. The price crashes, but it can also go downwards next day. So it's like moving average of order one. Yeah. We did loom box. Oh, then it's... let's take the residuals of the series. So we tested that we have no autocorrelation in the series. Then we take some further stuff. Oh, no, actually, this is the asset. So no autocorrelation in the Euro stocks. Now let's go to the S&P 500. Again, let's calculate the autocorrelation. The null, no autocorrelation. Then let's calculate the test statistic and compare that thirdly to the probability distribution. We get the p-value of 0.4, the null station power, no autocorrelation. We do not reject the null station power. Thirdly, these results also suggest that it is ARMA 1-1 order. And then thirdly, the WIC series, again, no autocorrelation. When the test statistic is compared to the probability distribution, quite high p-value, we do not reject the null station power, no autocorrelation. So from this stage, we conclude or make a preliminary assumption or conclusion that ARMA 1-1 is a good modeling choice, that we should continue with this choice. Our model has no autocorrelation, meaning that our model does not violate the assumptions of the OLS.
This is the assumptions of the strict exogeneity.
And then I'll let you decide this. We can have a break now, and then this forecasting can be a little bit heavy. So let's have a 15-minute break now, and then let's continue with the forecasting. Welcome back. For the sake of the practicalities, if you want to send a message through a course, I believe you should be able to do it through this announcement folder here under general information on Moodle. So just click here and then add a new new conversation or whatever it is in English. So if you want to communicate with someone, I believe you should be able to do it that via this channel. For example, if you want to ask something from other students or something. Then question number five. First of all, let's look at the question sheet. Forecasting using ARMA models. So here we have quite long range of data, around 30 year, or actually not that long, over 20 years of data. So from June 99 till the end of the 2020. And this this period includes two major crises. First of all, the global financial crisis of 2008, and then the COVID-19 pandemic. So in these forecasting exercises, we are estimating a model, and by using the estimates of the model, we're trying to forecast what's happening in the future value. So we're trying to predict this crisis. Let's continue then. First of all, one note also with respect to this data code. I looked it more carefully through today, and I found that the data course with respect to the forecasting is insufficient. I'll have to update that. So sorry for the inconvenience in that extent. I'll have to write new code there. I'll skip the story why that was the case, but I will update the data code soon. So you'll have as good data, as good code as in this case. So that will come in a few days. So question number five, first of all, we need two subsamples. In subsample one, we want to forecast the global financial crisis. So first of all, let's isolate the data window and then the crisis period. And the same thing for the COVID-19 pandemic. The data before the outbreak of the pandemic and then what happened during the pandemic. And then let's start forecasting. Based on the previous exercise, we arrived at the conclusion that our model is ARMA 1.1. So let's use that model. So what we do here, we take the data before the global financial crisis, and we estimate that we make an estimation based on ARMA 1.1 order. That's our model. Then we calculate static forecast. So what happens in the static forecasting? This is our range of observation. So what we do in static forecast, we calculate a model based on these forecasts. And then we make a future prediction based on this model. So first of all, we predict the first observation after the after our sample period, then the second, and then this. So for example, if our data ended last year,
we use that data to calculate the values of January this month and next, what happens in the next month, and then over 2 years ahead. So this is a static forecast, what's happening in the static forecast. And also, so technically what's happening here, as we're using mean values, so we're trying to predict that value. Expect conditional on this given date, the expected value of tomorrow.
That's based on the model we're using. So that's our model, and then we calculate the confidence intervals.
So for example, if our forecast, that's our data, and our forecast is like that, we calculate the confidence intervals in order to see where the true value is. It's the true value will be somewhere here based on the confidence interval, because in sampling, there's always error involved in calculating measures, calculating calculation. But that's the confidence intervals.
Okay, here we are comparing the values. Okay, here. Now let's show some pictures before we go into that. So here, our model is based on this data. Look, the final observation is huge upward spike. That's that's just before the Lehman bankruptcy happened. So it's the one observation before the bankruptcy of the Lehman brothers. So here, we observe our model is mean reverting. It's reverting around center moment, and it seems to be its variations are quite stable. It's not perfectly constant, but it's quite constant. But then there's a huge upward spike. So our prediction is based on this. If I show you the values of the, and this is our model we're using in forecasting. So here, what is it? First of all, compare the values of the parameters to their standard error, you can see that both of them are statistically significant. If you take this value and divide it by this, you can see that it's over 2, and also in this case, meaning that both of these parameters are statistically significant. Here, what is interesting is that AR is the persistence of the model. Meaning that how the lagged value from the past affects the future value. This value is not that high. It's like half. This means that lower the value, lower the persistence of the model. But then, in addition, we observe that there's a moving average component in the series. Like, think about yesterday, there was a bad news, bad report from Nokia, it's also affecting this data. And this element in the series is higher than the persistence persistence element. And it has an opposite sign. So this means, in other words, when this parameter is pulling the process in the same direction, there's another parameter that is pulling it into opposite direction. Then let's look. So given this value here, our preliminary assumption is that our forecast will be negative. So let's see whether that's the case. That's the black line. So the previous, this value here was a huge upward spike, upward. So when the negative parameter is dominating the process, the model predicts that the next value reverts to the mean. But here, in our case, this is what happens in reality, and this is the bankruptcy of the Lehman. So one period before, there was a huge upward spike in fear, and then when the Lehman Brothers went bankruptcy, there was even larger jump to the upwards. So this means, unfortunately, our model was not able to detect financial crisis. Well, we shouldn't be that mad about that or that disappointed, because we could also ask from a physician to predict like earthquakes that are more physical phenomena, and they're not able to do that, and we're trying to model human behavior that's 100 times more complex than earthquakes. So in other words, it's really hard to predict a financial crisis. They just happen, like COVID-19 pandemic. Most likely we will see a similar picture, that crisis just happened and our model was not able to detect it. But then let's continue. Then the red lines are here, the confidence intervals. So overall, our model, overall the realized values of the series remain the boundaries, and that's a good thing. Huge crisis happened, but then the series starts to remain within our confidence interval, implying that there's some accuracy in our model. And this is how our model behaves. So here, after a while, our model converges to the zero. And this, all of these observations here are these predictions ahead based on our model. And why is this model? And this means that our model mean reverts, because the moving average component or parameter. Sorry?
Moving average is more prevalent.
Yes.
Than the error of the regression.
Or the persistence.
Persistence, yeah.
Yes.
But did we do any kind of stationary test for the year? Like, it sounded like there was weekly stationary.
Yes.
Could it be the reason that it could actually do something like differencing or something that could make it more stationary and then could get better results?
I believe here the underlying problem is that we are using a linear model.
Mm-hmm.
So meaning that when we assume that our variation remains constant, and then there's a financial crisis, that's a outlier in constancy, it's really difficult to our model trying to go in the right direction. So what I'd rather recommend is using a variance process that is better able to detect the time varying variation in variance. So that when the variation is time varying, sometimes it's the variance is like down, then it increases and then it smooths and then it increases again. We would like to use a model like that that can detect the variation in the variability in variance better. That's more like the underlying process. So here, after a huge spike, the memory term of our model becomes activated, and then our model reverts back to the mean, its long run behavior. Secondly, let's calculate a recursive forecast. Here
we are only making one step ahead forecast. Again, this is our sample. And we're making only one step ahead forecast. So first of all, we are using similar model like above. We're using this sample to forecast this value. But when our model is recursive, forecasting, then this is what happens in the first step. Then what happens in the second step is that we increase our sample. We add the realized observation of this to our sample, and then we forecast second observation, but it is again one step ahead. So what finally at the 28th step, we have all of these observations. We're forecasting hopefully you're able to read it, but we are not now making a forecast that increases the sample every time and it predicts the next value ahead. That's what's happening here. Let's calculate it. And compare it to the values. Maybe I'll write. Dark green, it is easier to see. Okay, those are black line is the forecast. That's the static forecast from earlier exercise. Blue is the realized value. Realized data points, and then
dark green is our recursive forecast, what we are adding now to the model. Then let's add the confidence intervals and other stuff. So again, here, the last value of our sample or all observations in the sample, last value of our sample was a spike upwards. Our model predicts that next what happens next is a downward movement, and that's again based on a moving average value. It's dominating the persistence. Negative sign is dominating the positive sign here. But then we also observe that this recursive forecasting is more, it moves more, changes more over time than the static forecast. But here, let's compare it to the realized value, that is the blue line. So here, it seems like it's going in the opposite direction than the blue line all the time. So for example, here, it goes upwards, blue line goes downwards, here it goes downwards, blue goes upwards. So our recursive forecast seems to not to be working well. It's always going to the wrong direction than the realized value. Why, and why is this so? It's because of the moving average. It's dominating the forecasting. The memory impact becomes activated, and then the forecast just can't handle this extreme movement in the series. So our conclusion is that preliminary conclusion just by visually examining the forecast is that static forecast is performing better than the rolling forecast. And most likely this is the case because of the financial crisis. We have such a huge outlier in the series or outlier behavior that recursive forecasts just doesn't work. But then as we want to do some statistical testing in addition to just visual examination, let's study the goodness of the forecast. So here I calculate the metrics. Okay, they're both here. So here, let's do it like that and print them again. That is, it looks better. So here, these are the forecasts of the static model, and these are the forecasts of the recursive forecast model. Here, the general idea is to compare the test statistic value, and lower the value, better the forecasting fit. ME, mean error, RM, SE, root mean squared error, MIE, moving absolute error, moving persistence error, moving absolute persistence error, and then autocorrelation coefficient. But when we compare these test statistics, we observe that the static forecast is better almost in each case. Moving persistence error being the only exception. Then another interesting thing is to compare a Thiel's U value. Here, the critical threshold is a value of 1. And that means when the value is below one, the forecast performs better than a naive forecast. And what is a naive forecast? It is a martingale process that's a forecast of the our expectations of the tomorrow value is same as the value of today. So that is a naive forecast. For example, if I look like a Nokia share price and I say tomorrow it will be the same price as today, my forecast is a naive forecast. So I just think that tomorrow is similar to today. So when the value is below one, that means that the forecast is better than the naive forecast. So in this case, our static forecast performs better than just by naively saying that tomorrow will be like today. But if we apply a recursive forecast, we would be better dealing with like saying that tomorrow is like today. It is so bad. Okay, that was for the global financial crisis. Secondly, let's try to forecast the COVID-19 pandemic. First of all, let's calculate our model, our static forecasts, confidence intervals, and then let's plot them. Actually, I think it's also helpful to do this similarly like earlier. So this is our data sample. This is our sample we're basing our forecast. It's revolves around mean value. There's some constancy. Then there's some changes in variability, but not that bad. For sure, there are some changes. And then this is our last value. So this is the December 2019. There was no huge spike. And in January 2020, World Health Organization said that COVID-19 pandemic is a global concern. So that's our previous. That's our sample. Then let's look at our model. How our parameters look like. So again, we have a moving average component and an AR component. And again, you know how to calculate the statistical significance. We observe immediately, but both of these parameters are statistically significant, but the moving average value is much higher than the persistence of the model. So we expect that we see even more dramatic downward movement in our predictions like in the earlier case. So let's look what our model fits with the reality. Okay, so before the outbreak of the pandemic, there was an only minor increase in series. Moving average dominates our prediction. We have a minor value here. And then the memory term starts to it becomes activated and dominates the series. The AR component and the forecast reverts to zero, converges to the long run mean value. So again, our immediate forecast did not catch the observed value, but overall, the observed series remains within the confidence interval. Then the recursive forecast. Okay, we're only will add a line, and let's set it dark green. It's easier to see. Becomes better readable. Okay, so here again, our recursive forecast seems to be not worth much. There's a downward spike in a realized value. The forecast moves into other, has a wrong sign. Negative value, positive value. Here they're going into the same direction. And then, but overall, you'll observe that when the realized value is going upwards, the forecast is moving into another direction. So this is a quite bad forecast. Accuracy, let's test statistically how good these both forecasts are, static and recursive. Here again, compare the values, and the smaller value is the better. So for example, comparing these values, almost in each case, the static forecast is better than the recursive forecast. Nevertheless, here, but in this case, so with respect to the COVID-19 pandemic, our sales value of the static forecast is above one, implying that just by saying tomorrow is like today is a better forecast than the forecast that our model offers. So this means that both of these models are quite bad. They're not able to capture the realized values. What we observe. So first of all, the first question is how to improve our models. And one of the possibilities is to parameterize more time varying volatility structure. It could be that could improve the forecast. And somehow trying to control the outliers of the series. For example, like in the earlier case, let's go. Earlier, we looked at the Arimo model. We could, for example, set a dummy variable in our Arimo model, like. And this dummy variable could, for example, control the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. So it would be like this. We would have like a variable like this. One becomes activated if 2020 if date is 2020 January or at all, and zero otherwise. So just by adding a dummy variable, we could try, that could improve our model. Okay, that was question numbers five, and then the last one. So what are we asked here? Oh, this is about interest rates. So we have 30 years of data. 30 years of data about the difference between the 10-year US government bond where 3-month treasury bill is subtracted. We're asked to do similar stuff as in the previous exercise, but a little additional stuff. So let's begin. First, let's load the data. First, it's the visual examination of the series, summary statistic. Okay, it seems like the series is behaving quite symmetrically. Median and mean are almost the same. Minimum and maximum value are around 2 units away from the mean, so it's quite symmetric, as well as the first and third quarter. Our variable, our series is, this number shouldn't be that high. Or yeah, so according to standard error, the mean value is the population value is quite close to this sample value. Then let's plot the data. This is what our data looks like. So this is a interest rate spread. Difference between the 10-year and 3-month interest rates. From here, we observe that the interest spread is increasing and then it is decreasing. And sometimes it becomes negative, meaning that the 3-month treasury yield is higher than the 10-month treasury yield. According to the expectations theory, when the slope of the term structure becomes negative, meaning that a longer maturity is smaller than the shorter maturity, that's a sign that the interest rates will start to decline in future, according to the expectations hypothesis. So here we observe that there's some movement up and down and up, but then after 2010, there's only mostly a downward drift. That's the last decade. So just by looking this picture, this suggests that there could be some structural change in the data. So let's study that. First of all, let's use Akaike and Schwartz to calculate our orders according to Akaike. Our optimal order is p value should be 2 and q value 0, meaning that AR of order 2. According to Schwartz, it's AR of order 1. we have contradictory results according to one information criteria is this, another information criteria says it's that. How to decide? Let's analyze it. Let's look at this stuff more closely. First of all, let's estimate our model based on AR2 order. Here, you observe immediately just by taking this AR1 value and divide it by its standard error that this value is over 1.96. So AR1 is strongly statistically significant. AR2 is not, and intercept is also statistically significant. So intercept being statistically significant, so significant here. First of all, when we take the value of the AR1 and subtract the value of AR2, that is calculate the sum of AR other recursive order, we get a value that's quite close to the one. So it could be a case that there's a unit root involved in hidden unit root in this process. Unit root means stochastic trend. Random behavior. So, like I said earlier, it seems that the series is mean reverting here, but then it starts to drift downwards. It could be the case that there's a shift in a process, in an underlying process, and earlier it was mean reverting, but then it started to drift downwards. So let's study that in more detail. First of all, what's the meaning of the intercept? So here we have a constant term that is statistically significant. Its intercept is basically here a zero, just a value of the zero. That if we value of the zero. So what's the interpretation of this? Let's start to look at that in more detail. So by definition, when we when the values of the other parameters of our model are set to zero, our intercept gives us the expected value. So the expected value of this interest rate spread when all predictors or regressors, that is AR1 and AR2, are set to zero. So usually when you think of the assumption overall estimator, when the estimator is unbiased, this is the case. The expected value without the time subscript, expected value of the, let's say, variable xt is some constant term, the mean term. So that's standard OLS theory. Standard statistical theory, OLS assumption. So let's take the mean value of the series and subtract the intercept from it in order to see whether this results in the zero. It is not. This means that intercept term is not equal to the sample mean. The intercept is something more. So alternatively, let's demean this series. So earlier the interpretation of the intercept was the expected value of the threat when other regressors are put to zero. So now let's put other regressions to their mean values and look what happened. Look, now study the intercept. So what we are just doing here, we are taking this series here and we are calculating the mean value and just subtracting the mean value of this series. So only thing where you should see here is that this only the difference in scaling, the behavior otherwise remains the same.
So I didn't get it. I mean, previously you said that there was a kind of image, possibly there was some kind of image juice.
Yes.
So are we allowed to do this image with just whether they are really?
That's the topic of next week. So here we are. Here we are studying unit root in another way. So here we are trying to understand what's happening in our time series, and our the suggestion is that there's a unit root involved there.
So that's a good thing. But here you see that there is the intercept term thing.
Yes.
When we find that that's not zero, and it found that that's not zero.
Yes.
What is the implication? What is the implication of this?
Okay, that's where we're heading next. Okay, so earlier, without D meaning, it was the expected value of the spread when the other regressors are zero. Now it's the expected value of the spread when other regressions are their mean values. So here, when we demean the series, we observe that the intercept is negative. This means that when the other regressors, AR1 and AR2, are at their mean value at the place where they are constant, this series is sloping downwards. So when the series is sloping downwards, there is some kind of force that is pressing the series downwards. So, and I said that, or well, let me say this in this way: if we made a subsample analysis, we would get a slightly different results. Most likely, if we left this final part of the sample out, we would not get downward sloping parameters. Or to say it in other words, the period from 2010, the decade of 2010s was a decade of decreasing interest rates. So this is the period where interest rates only fell downwards. They were not going upwards anytime soon. And what happened in 1020s, that was the time when central banks operated using zero lower bound monetary policies. So what central banks did last decade, they not only put their key interest rates at the lower bound, effective lower bound, in the case of the ECB, even at the negative level, but they always bought all kind of long-term government bonds from the markets, decreasing the long-term yields downwards. So this is what is economically happening here, or as we haven't shown that this could be a hypothesis or research question, whether what's the role of the central bank in decreasing the interest rate spreads downwards. But here we are just saying that when these things happened, it behaved like a random process that sloped downwards. Okay, here we observe that our AR2 order is not statistically significant, so maybe we'll just leave it away. What's the difference? The intercept becomes a little bit higher. AR coefficient looks like to be the sum of these two coefficients, almost. So there's a little improvement in the series, not much. Or actually, when we do this change, when our AR1 coefficient becomes a little bit closer to the unity one, that means that it could be, well, it begs for a question whether this there's a unit root process involved in this parameter. To compare the results, let's add a MI1 order. And it isn't doing much. Let's leave it away. And if we test a restricted model, if we restrict our AR1 parameter to the one, and this and calculate the test statistic and compare it to the probability distribution, we get a value. We are from the p value, we can see that we are in the rejection regime, so we reject the restricted model and think that we reject the restricted model, and it is more plausible or more probable that the unrestricted model is better. Yes, when we reject the restriction that some parameter is constant, it is more likely that it is the case that it is rather something random, something that has a inherent variability in it. Then the subsample analysis. Okay, we become forecasting again. So this is the same thing as we did in the previous exercise. Let's start forecasting. Again, we isolate the sample before bankruptcy of the Lehman Brothers and see whether there's some change. And then we calculate the ARIMA model, AR1 model based on this sample. And this is our model. This is what our model looks like. There's some missing value there involved. Interesting. I can't remember. I can't. Could I set that it is ignores the missing value also in the case of the mean? Okay, it should be. Okay, let's just ignore that. And then, so let's, in addition to the AR1 model, let's calculate ARMA11 model. So what we want to do is we want to compare these two models, AR1 and ARMA11. So the underlying intuition is here that when we added something that isn't significant in the ARMA11 model, the MI1 parameter seems to be irrelevant. So when we added something small thing into our model, this should work as a robustness check that both of our models behave similarly. When there's only a minor change in the model, they should behave similarly. So let's study whether that is the case, that we add something completely irrelevant into the model and our model results change. So let's calculate a recursive forecast. So
we are doing this thing,
one step ahead forecast and increasing our sample each time after forecast. Whoa, we are forecasting 148 observations, so that's like over 10 years. So we're forecasting quite long range. Okay, so our forecast is based on the period before the financial crisis, and then we're forecasting using this model. We're forecasting the period after the outbreak of the financial crisis, after the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic. So in other words, if our results differ using these two models, that means that there has happened a structural change in the model. There shouldn't be any difference between ARMA11 and ARMA10 model because there's no economic difference in this model. So that's a recursive forecast. Then recursive forecast for another model. That's ARMA11 model. First, let's test that our forecast errors are unbiased. And when this is the case, our intercept term should be zero. That means not statistically significant. In addition, our parameter value should be statistically significant and be close to one. So let's see whether this holds. Intercept term, we reject the null, that means there's bias. Parameter different from zero, That's a good thing, but there seems to be some bias, and this bias seems to be related to the interceptor. That was ARMA AR1 model, and now ARMA 1.1. And we get the similar result. Our intercept term is different from zero, that is statistically significant, implying a bias in intercept. Then our forecast coefficient is statistically significant, close to one. So we have some, there seems to be some bias in the data. So let's continue our statistical testing and test whether let's then make a robustness check and test whether this intercept term is different from zero, as different from one. And that's done by using F-test, null hypothesis, restricted model. What is our restriction? Our forecast coefficient equals to one. This is our test statistic, and when we compare it to the probability distribution, we reject the null, meaning that we restrict the restricted model. So it seems to be the case that the coefficient is also, the forecast coefficient is also different from one. And when it's from different from one, it is not accurate or efficient. Then let's look at the ARMA 1.1 model. Same thing. The null is restricted model, and when the null is restricted, rejected, like in this case, it is more likely that the unrestricted model is better. And when we restrict the restriction that the forecast coefficient is one, it is not accurate. Then there are these highlighted lines. Here are some further robustness checks if the earlier result would have been different. But they are not, in this case, they are not relevant, but that's code for you if you want to do something with it. You can find it. It shouldn't affect the results. So let's see what will happen. So if we reject the null, this means that our forecast accuracy of these models differ, even though it should not. And looking at the p-value, we reject the null. The result is not the most. Forecast accuracy of these models differ, even though they should not. Make a further robustness check. Let's square the mean squared error and see whether that changes the result. Okay, now we are squaring the okay, it's nevertheless, the p-value is a little bit higher, but it's nevertheless below the 0.05. So this implies that we added some nonlinearities, some non we squared the error terms and added some nonlinearities there, but this improves a result a little bit. But nevertheless, we reject the null. And finally, let's calculate Granger-Newbold test. And this is for the additional support for the earlier Diebold-Mariano test. So our null hypothesis is that the differences in dispersion, that is the variability of the series, are zero. So we added something irrelevant into another model. That means that dispersions of these models should be zero. So let's look whether our p-value is below 0.05. And yes, it is. Strongly statistically significant, meaning that when we reject the null, the differences in dispersion or variability are not zero. So in other words, we added something irrelevant into a model and tested the differences of this model into a model that's almost similar to it, and the results were different overall. So most likely it is the case that when we used sample before the financial crisis to predict everything what happened over the next 10 years, there's some random element has emerged into a series after that, and that most likely is the unit root. And this unit root is most likely, or this is a research question caused by what central banks have been doing. They've been manipulating their interest rates, longer rates and shorter rates. And because of these manipulations, old behavior of the interest rates has been replaced by a new behavior of interest rates. And that was all this time. And again, I will shortly upload these videos and the next questions, and then I will upload the stata code that was insufficient. I will do that in next few days, and I'll thank you, and we'll see you again next week.